Part 1, Chapter 4, The Nature of Human Imprisonment. As we have seen, the candidate for new, liberating life must first of all form the image of the immortal, heavenly, original man in the process of sanctification through which he must live. Through a fundamental change of life, he must build up this mental conception, this thought image within his field of respiration. You probably know that all thought images created by man are taken up into his field of respiration. Thoughts are things, light flashes, light impulses of the brain. These light rays are compounds of a very rarefied matter which can be detected and even weighed by means of very sensitive instruments. So thoughts are things, real material forms, though of a much more rarefied nature and construction than our gross material bodies. These thought forms remain within or near their creator's immediate field of action. They unite with thought forms of the same kind and become more and more powerful thereby. When we do not mentally animate these thought beings within our field of respiration, and they consequently remain at rest, they resemble cloudy accumulations that show a distinct motion like the cloud formations in the air. If we observe a person from this point of view, we see these thought clouds appear at the right-hand side of the body, at the height of waist, then rise above the head, only to descend and disappear at his left side of the body, again at the height of waist. When observing another person, this circulation appears to be clockwise. While observing the process within ourselves, the movement appears to be counterclockwise. Since they are creatures, living beings, these thought clouds must be fed. We have to understand that thoughts are living entities of a definite order and class. For their maintenance, they depend upon the light power, the light matter of the brain from which they originated. These beings will therefore entreat and, if possible, even compel their creators to feed and maintain them with the same thought power out of which they are created. We would like to fully describe the way in which this coercion is exercised by the offspring of our thoughts. When a human being succumbs to this completely natural compulsion, as he does daily, almost hourly, then we distinctly see forms originate from these mental clouds circulating within the field of respiration, the most expressive external characteristics of which are perhaps the eyes. To the degree in which the form is being mentally fed, its eyes emanate a paralyzing, hypnotizing influence with increasing force. Hypnotized by his own mental offspring, the person in question is driven to action, to a series of actions, and thereby to complete slavery to his own phantoms. In this way, all of us, in the course of aeons, have become slaves of our delusions, of our prejudices and vices which had taken shape in our field of respiration through the working of our thoughts, and which we had kept up and fed until they finally began to dominate us. The mode of life which we so often regret and so frequently offer powerless resistance, the mode of life which embitters our life because we become disgusted with ourselves and are in danger of losing all self-respect, is the result of that compulsion proceeding from this circulation of habits of thought, from our mental conceptions in the field of respiration. Humanity is ill, mortally ill, a victim of its own creative drive, and there is no earthly man of whom this statement is not true. Because dialectical man, second by second, abuses the creative faculty of his brain we mention in such a horrible, chaotic manner, with all the fatal results associated therewith, he has often degraded himself below the animal. When the Bible fulminates against the abuse of the holy creative function, it refers to this destructive application of the mental faculty, which is subjugated to an almost unbounded desire life and its consequences. Imprisoned within the vicious circle of habits of thought, many people are thus too black and too depraved to be touched. If we fathom our own heart and place our lives in the judging light of the brotherhood, we must admit that, imprisoned in the chain of habits of thought, we have experienced undesired thoughts forcing their way to the surface of our consciousness for unknown reasons to follow their calamitous course. How many times have we not exclaimed, "I don't do what I want, but do the very thing I hate"? What then is the cause of this disastrous, undesired stream of lower thought life which escapes our control to such an alarming extent? Generally speaking, the cause is the blood. The desire, the susceptibility for unholy living lies anchored in our blood. Dialectics are rooted fundamentally in our blood. If we endeavor to check the blood impetus of nature by the culture of our will, we may succeed in canalizing the blood in some respects, but it will make itself felt in other respects more strongly than ever. Every dialectical human being, without exception, is in some respect or other, even if sometimes clandestinely, more dangerous than a ferocious animal. The passion of the blood forces its way no matter what. This is a matter of survival for the human animal. How does this passion, this primal passion, enter our blood? To answer this oppressive question, we must be very detailed. To date, the school of the Rosicross has restricted itself to merely philosophical and mystical statements on this subject, but now the time has come for a more scientific explanation. In our philosophy, we speak of a fourfold personality. We would like to approach this fourfold personality in a way entirely different to that so far employed. Our material body manifests itself in and through a concentrated ether field. Inasmuch as this ether field works and acts within our body, we speak of the etheric body since we live from and through the ethers. Immediately outside the material body, the etheric body retains the shape of the material body, but soon merges into the field of manifestation or respiration. The mental faculty in the brain is likewise an ether compound, albeit of a very rarefied composition. Furthermore, there is consciousness present in the body. It is to be found in the cerebrospinal system, the serpent fire column, and we know that this fire of consciousness is ultimately connected with the blood and the nerve fluid. This consciousness, together with the blood and the nerve fluid, is governed by our desire essence, from which it can be explained. This desire essence is thus the inner nucleus of our dialectical material existence. It is the I, the blood I, the earthly soul. Its seat in the body can be localized as the liver spleen system. This location is to be understood not merely in a figurative, but also in a literal sense. The liver, the spleen, the kidneys, and the adrenal glands, plus the solar plexus, the pelvic cerebral center, form the realm of the blood I, the desire being. Man lives by virtue of the liver, the supreme organ. By its very nomenclature, we can discern that the original name, givers of some nations, knew about this. In the liver-spleen system and its attendant organs, the blood, the nerve fluid, the serpent fire, and thus the entire person is controlled and kept in a certain state of being. All those forces and their hormonal effects which cannot be explained out of this nature are therefore removed from the blood in this system. We stated that the nucleus of the I-being resides in this system. It lies enclosed in the spleen. During our waking state, it lies, coiled up as it were, in the spleen, but during sleep it steps outside. The coil unrolls, a cloud-like ribbon appears from the spleen, and this cloud forms a figure in the respiration field, namely, the form of the true dialectical man, the desire being the true blood ape. This I usually looks quite different from our material form. We would rather not give a description. You will understand that this desire being, appearing in the field of manifestation, is complete different from the thought beings discussed above. During sleep, this, our true dialectical I, can withdraw from the material body to a fairly great distance, but by no means as far as the mental body. Once you are aware that all your nightly experiences take place in this desire being and are absorbed by it, and that this blood I fully belongs to nature, it will become clear to you why it is quite impossible for it to receive impulses of a liberating nature. The natural eye cannot be made receptive to higher life. The natural eye must perish, for flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. If for some reason or other we are highly agitated, the eye being leaves the spleen without our knowledge, ready, as it were, to face a potential aggressor. Besides being the residence of the eye being, the spleen is also the principal entrance gate to the body for ether forces. The desire being feeds on these forces, lives from them, and thus controls the entire bodily system. Finally, the mental phantoms, the origin and behavior which we described to you, influence the spleen quite substantially. The process connected herewith can be described as follows. The desire being impels the brain to use its creative faculties, its mental activity, in accordance with the nature and needs of the blood eye, thus populating the entire respiration or ether field of the microcosm with mental beings. Each of these thought images forms a focus for ether powers dwelling in the manifestation field and transforms them according to its type. In this way, the ether field is treated by all these thought beings in a particular way, and the result thereof is lapped up by the desire being, the eye, via the spleen. All these forces circulate as if through a sluice gate. They enter the body through the spleen and leave it through the liver. Thus we see that the entire process of life serves to feed the desire being, the blood being, the eye within us. That is the sinister image of our reality. Now, when you completely survey both the poverty and the fatefulness of all this, and consequently comprehend your captivity in every fiber of your being, when all these matters are intensively studied and proven in detail during our conferences and services, so that even a child can understand them, you could be inclined to view all these discussions as cruel afflictions. Like the writings of Edgar Allan Poe, who minutely described lugubrious situations, prisons, and tortures in breathtaking vividness which make you cry out, "For goodness sake, stop it! I know that I live in a prison, but what is the good of measuring and defining its walls and the nature of the confinement down to the tiniest detail?" Nobody, however, can rise from the grave of nature unless he has experienced to the very marrow the chill of the mortuary in which he lives. No one can tread the path of redemption unless he has perceived the ubiquitous breath of death, and no one will behold the dawn of eternal freedom unless he is ready to carry the cross of truth through the hours of midnight. Whoever is not strong enough to bear this should keep away from our work. "The gospel of Jesus Christ is solely for the strong," says Paul, and rightly so, and this gospel begins with the unmasking. If, however, you do indeed taste like us the bitter wormwood of the prison, if you are prepared to imbibe the sour vinegar, then we shall lead you to Paul's mystery of salvation, to the method of healing. Lo, I tell you a mystery of healing, a mystery of recovery. We shall all be changed. The perishable must put on the imperishable, the mortal must put on immortality. Then shall come to pass the saying that is written, "Death is swallowed up in victory." But now let us analyze this mystery. The true pupil is able, in his broken and mortal microcosm, to construct amidst this perishable world something imperishable and immortal, namely, the mental conception of immortal man, the mental image of the immortal heavenly being. This conception must be formed in a manner entirely different from that of the ordinary mental phantoms outlined above. Such a mental conception can only be accomplished by a person who still possesses the spirit spark atom in the right heart, ventricle. If this spirit spark atom can be touched by the infrared light of the gnosis, a wonderful effect begins in the thymus, an organ of endocrine secretion situated under the sternum. For, in this state, the spirit spark atom begins to vibrate vigorously and touches the thymus with its light impulses, which then starts to secrete a hormone into the stream of lesser blood circulation. The thymus is active in childhood, then shrinks and lapses into a state of latency. Through the vibration of the spirit spark atom touched by the Gnostic light, the thymus is reanimated. As soon as the blood loaded with this particular hormone reaches the head and consequently touches the brain, the most wondrous thoughts, namely those characteristic of the true seeker, arise due to the effects of the blood in the brain centers. One can say that due to these wonderful effects, the image of immortal man in its embryonic state has already been conceived, entirely beyond the influence of the desire being, the blood eye. As we have observed, however, this mental image is of quite different nature, vibration and composition from any other mental being of which we have spoken. It therefore cannot circulate through the spleen liver lock system. This image radiates quietly as an extraordinary light in the respiration field, generally remaining in front of the candidate eye to eye with him. Now and then, it retreats from the whole microcosmic system, from the auric being, attracted by the infrared light of the gnosis, and returns invigorated. The thymus hormone, however, which caused all this, is of course led downwards again through the blood circulation, and the agency of the desire body then causes this inimical substance to be removed from the blood by means of the kidneys. In the liver and kidneys, the blood is cleansed of all substances alien to the eye nature. If, however, the spirit spark atom continues to vibrate with all the associated consequences just described, a strange state of cleavage, a situation well known to many seekers, develops in our existence, a state of living two lives. While seeking, we continue building our supernatural mental conception. Through the aid of the spiritual school, inner discipline, and the sustaining force of the power field, we continue purifying our mental divine image from delusion and deceit. In the meantime, we live the ordinary life of the Ephesian, and externally little or nothing in our life changes. The years flit by, and at best, we bask now and then in the mental image of the imperishable one carried with us. And now we have to warn you, this dream state during which we delight in our mental creation can last very long, too long, even for many incarnations. This is because the desire being not only biologically purifies the blood via the spleen liver system, but seemingly cooperates with your inclination for seeking. The desire being, the eye full of Atlantean slyness, has a cultural background going back eons. Just as the head has its brain, and the heart likewise, so the pelvis also has a brain full of moon brain consciousness in the solar plexus. Led by this intelligence, the eye attempts to enshroud your mental conception of the Eternal One, born out of the spirit spark atom, with delusion, with all kinds of speculation, and with absolute untruths. Prometheus is thus literally bound, enchained. The image of the imperishable one is encapsulated in the respiration field or connected with natural occult and natural religious developments. That is why the spiritual school watches so carefully to keep its work alive and to guard the purity of its doctrine, for in this way the school can best help each pupil. It must always take an example from its predecessors in time who, due to all sorts of hindrances of this nature, saw their work prematurely terminated again and again. And now, bearing all this in mind, hear the mystery of salvation, the mystery of healing. If the candidate keeps his mental conception of the Immortal One pure and clear by means of a truly pursued and practiced pupilship, and entrusts himself fully to the guidance of the spiritual school, then this new God-born embryonal being will develop to full growth. Ultimately, the candidate will carry along with him the completed image of the original heavenly man, born of the infrared pole of the light of the Gnosis. You know that all ordinary natural mental phantoms circulate through the spleen-liver-lock system, urged by the ultraviolet pole of the Gnosis light and following a clear decision of the pupil's will. The mental conception of the heavenly man must now also proceed to circulation through the spleen-liver-lock system, if necessary, by inner force, since the desire being, the I, will refuse its access. You will be able to foresee the attendant consequences through this new circulation of entirely different ether powers of pure Christ ethers. The fortress of the I is attacked. The I, the desire being, is driven from the pelvic center, and a new desire being is born. Now you will perhaps understand the ancient myth from the dawn of dialectical time, the myth of Adam and Eve. Adam is Manas, the thinker, the mental image of the immortal one. Eve is the new I, the new desire being which must manifest itself out of the side of the body. These two, this man and this woman, the desire being is always represented as feminine due to its polarization. This new Adam and this new Eve must be born in our system. When they unite in holy labor, the new transfigurated man, bodily, will be born of them. This is the mystery of salvation as mentioned by Paul. This is the method, the perishable dialectical nuclear organ of the bodily man, the spleen-liver system, must put on the imperishable. The imperishable must infiltrate the perishable. Then the words that are written, the jubilating words, will come true. Death is swallowed up in victory. Whoever is willing to tread this way of the cross will be victorious. Finally, the spear thrust into his side, into the spleen, will demonstrate that the death of the earthly man is complete. Then only the heavenly man will grow from eternity to eternity. Just as we carried the image of the earthly man, so we will then carry the image of the heavenly one. However, first comes all that pertains to the soul, and afterwards the spiritual. With both feet planted firmly in reality, we begin our Via Dolorosa towards the morning of resurrection.